Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender. Thanks for being with us this afternoon. Well, it's the beginning of a new fall season. The university is buzzing with activity here at Northwestern and all across the country as students return to their dorms and their classrooms. Parents are busy getting their children ready for school, kind of frantic to pick up those last items from that supply list, picking up school clothes and that new shiny pair of tennis shoes if you have younger children. I can almost hear that sigh of relief, though, from parents across the country getting ready to exhale following the drop off to school in the mornings. I admit I have been one of those this week. Well, what happens when we find ourselves kind of spinning out of control with these duties and activities that cause us to press toward this idea of perfectionism and achievement that seems rampant in our culture today? Whether it's getting our kids ready for school or getting ourselves ready for work, whether it's striving for that next project. It's a culture that values speed and efficiency and image and busyness. Do you ever find yourself kind of aching for another way to live? Well, if so, you are in for a treat, because on the show today is one of my very favorite authors, Shauna Nyquist. She's the author of Cold Tangerines, Bread and Wine, and a great devotional called Savor. But her new book explores a different concept. It's a concept of practicing being present over the practice of trying to be perfect. And this book comes from a place of vulnerability and her own struggle to kind of free herself from this frantic culture of busyness and how to live instead in a love and connectedness with the people in her life who matter the most. And maybe you found yourself in this space as well. Well, this book is called Present Over Perfect, Leaving Behind Frantic for a Simpler, More Soulful Way of Living. Let me tell you a little bit about Shauna. Shauna Nyquist is the author of Cold and Tangerines, Bittersweet also. She's married to Aaron, and they live in Chicago with their two boys, Henry and Mac. Shauna is a bookworm, a beach bum, and a passionate gatherer of people, especially around the table. Welcome, Shauna.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. And of course, it's fall, so it is a little bit busy and people are going a little bit crazy. So it was nice to sit down and read a book that reflected that from another mom and writer and speaker. So thanks for sharing that with all of us who are frantically getting people ready for school.
Oh, thank you. You know, when we realized that the book was going to come out essentially right for back to school, we said, it's either the exact worst time or maybe the exact best time for a book like this.
Well, I don't know if you're like me or if you're listening today and you kind of stack up the books that you didn't quite get to over the summer and you enjoy maybe that time once you get the kids off to school where you might have even a half hour to yourself to read something. And if that's true, then this is for sure the perfect fall book.
Thank you.
So how did you get to this point? You're a busy author, you're a busy mom, you're writing, you're attending conferences, you're speaking at a bazillion places. When did you get to the point where you decided that maybe this wasn't the life that you had thought of that you wanted to be living now?
No, I think it was when I realized that the key words to describe my life, if you had asked me what were the words I wanted to describe my life, I would have said joyful, playful, warm, relational, connected, maybe even a little bit silly and spontaneous. But I think if I'm honest, the words that described my life those years ago was the biggest word was exhausted and empty, isolated, discouraged. Even the great things in my life started to feel like work because I was so deeply depleted.
Mm. And what kind of led to that point? I know we may look at other people's lives and people may look at yours and say, well, of course she's depleted, but, you know, I'm not even doing all of those things and I'm depleted too. So relate, if you can, your way of life to really many of the ways of lives of women, especially today.
You know, I think the most important thing to keep in mind is just because it works for someone else doesn't mean it would work for you. And just because it's too fast for someone else, you know, we're so different. And so for me, I was too busy. I was traveling too much, working too much. And a lot of that came out of a desire to meet other people's expectations. Mm-hmm. And so instead of having a meaningful framework by which I said, this is all I can do, and anything else than that, anything beyond that starts to affect my health and my family negatively, I just said, like, well, I don't know, someone needs me. Somebody needs me. And I didn't have a meaningful framework for how to define what was ever going to be too much. And so I just said yes and yes and yes, rather indiscriminately, believing falsely, I know now, that there would just always be more energy in the tank if I needed it. What I realized at a certain point was there just wasn't.
Mm. What was that turning point when you knew you couldn't live this life that essentially you'd created for yourself?
Yeah, I had a moment at a hotel in Dallas. I'd been speaking at an event. I had done 3 events that month, which is too much. And I laid on the bed in the middle of the day, my shoes on, my coat on, everything. And I just said, if anybody else wants to try to live this life I've created for myself, they're welcome to it. But I don't want it anymore. I cannot carry the weight of the life I've created for myself anymore. Mm. And so, you know, like anything, like any meaningful change, it doesn't happen overnight. But that moment was a turning point for me. And I went home and I had 4 conversations, first with my husband, then with my small group, then with my mentor, and then with my dad, who's one of my best friends, kind of just letting them know, like, I don't know exactly what this journey is going to look like. I promise it won't be like super quick and easy. It probably will be 2 steps forward, 3 steps back, but I'm asking you to go along with me and I'm letting you know that I'm going on this journey. I don't know exactly where I'll end up, but it's going to be really different than where I am right now.
So one of those things that you decided to implement in your life was just that task, that difficult task of saying no. And I'm wondering how you kind of came to find that word in your vocabulary, given this cultural need to keep on going and proving and presenting yourself as someone who's perfect.
You know, it was very, I'm shocked at how difficult it was for me. And to be honest, it's still really difficult for me. I believe more in the consequences of my answers these days. So I believe that it's more important to say no than I used to, but it's still not easy. But a lot of it came down to picturing my life in terms of concentric circles and putting kind of my own health and soul and my faith right at the center with my husband and our boys. Those things are just right at the very center of those circles. And then one step out, my parents, my brother, then my very best friends, then our neighbors and our church community, then my colleagues, out. And I try every time I'm presented with an opportunity, I remind myself of the reality that you're going to disappoint somebody. Mm-hmm. Every time you say yes to something, it's a no to something else. We're finite people with finite amounts of time. But if at all possible, I want to disappoint people on the outer edges of that circle more often than I do the people in the center of that circle. And so I try to ask myself every time I make a decision, will this have positive or negative consequences for the people at the innermost part of this circle?
Well, and you're so accomplished, and it seems like maybe when you're saying no to things, maybe you're thinking in the back of your head that those opportunities will not come again. And yet, as I'm reading your book, I'm realizing that opportunities do continue to come, but they're coming maybe in a different manner than what you would have expected even a year ago.
Well, you know, the great thing, there were a couple of people that kind of teased me about this. When I first started writing about it, especially when I was posting more about it on my blog, there were a couple of friends who were like, hey, like, I love you being honest about this and everything, but like, you know, people are going to, they're not going to invite you to speak, right? Like, that's what you're doing, right? And I was like, right, that's totally the plan. Yeah. I actually want to live a different way. And so the great thing about writing a book like this is people already know my values and my priorities for this season. So they're welcome to ask me to do things, but they know exactly where my heart is and where my energy is. And so it's a lot easier to say no than it was before, when I had essentially like trained a whole group of people I'd work with to know that I would just never say no to anything. Hmm. So now I get a question and it says, you know, I know this probably isn't something you can do, but it makes it a lot easier to say no.
And then you have people like me calling and saying, wait, people need to hear this information. You have to come on. So it's just a different group of people who are now begging for your time.
Well, and even that is something, you know, just there's a schedule by and how many conversations like this I have, and a whole team of people that helps me make these decisions. So the ones I do, I'm happy to do. I've chosen them. And then there's a certain amount of others we just can't do. And that's just how life is.
Well, I'm talking to Shauna Nyquist today about her book, Present Over Perfect, Leaving Behind Frantic for a Simpler, More Soulful Way of Living. We'll talk with Shauna more about how exactly she has done that, maybe some practices she's put to work in her life that have allowed her to live a more soulful way of life. We'll be right back on Connecting Faith. If you're listening and you'd like to get your hands on a copy of her book, you can send us an email and we will put you on the list and do that drawing at the end of the show. You can just go straight to myfaithradio.com, click on Connecting Faith. You'll be able to submit your name and address right there on the site. We'll be right back on Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender, talking with Shauna Nyquist today about her book, Present Over Perfect. She's been talking about just how she left behind a very frantic way of life, or maybe a simpler way of life. Shauna, you did put some practical things into your book as far as how physically you did this, from maybe cleaning out some closets or some clutter around your house, from even something more simple than that, but that made profound sense to me, getting pajamas. Talk a little bit about that and why that was important for you.
You know, it's been so fun to get messages from people now who are saying, I just got some pajamas, and I know exactly what that means. And so essentially, I've always, I don't know why, but I always like wore workout clothes to bed, or especially if I was traveling, then it would just be one less thing to pack. I'd bring my workout clothes and I could also sleep in them. Or I'd wear like a ratty old sweatshirt, you know, from like a summer camp I went to 20 years ago. And then I read Arianna Huffington's book, not even the one on sleep, Thrive, the one that came before that. And she said something like, you have to tell your body what it's about to do. The reason you put on workout clothes is you let your body know we're about to go be active. But then you put on pajamas as a way of signaling to your body it's time to rest. And it's a way of honoring the end of the day. And she makes it like this very beautiful, compelling case for kind of the way of nurturing yourself by letting your body know that it's time to rest. And I needed, like, I need so many different, my impulse is not to nourish or nurture myself. My impulse is to be pretty hard on myself. And so I read that and I went, okay, I think that's a little thing I can do that can create a little nurturing in my life. And I have to tell you, it's like my favorite thing in the world. I am like a pajama junkie at this point. And it really is. It's such a loving signal to myself. Hey, we're not working right now. We're home and we're being quiet and we're resting our bodies. And I think it's just little changes like that that we can make in our lives, very practical daily choices that say it doesn't all have to be hustle. It doesn't all have to be multitasking and frantic. Your pajamas don't have to do double duty on the treadmill. They get to just be their own thing and to communicate rest and grace.
Well, you write that so much of adulthood is kind of looking at those expectations that you had for yourself and expectations that others have of you. And you write about just kind of peeling off the layers of that so that you're not looking at other people's expectations of you, but really what your expectations of you and what God expects of you. And it seemed like those were very different things. Can you talk more about that? What kind of expectations society seems to kind of put on us as women, and how you've been kind of reeling against that?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of different ways to talk about this, but one of the first things that comes to mind is right now, in the last several years, culture has changed so rapidly, and we live in such an image-driven culture, right? So what matters is the picture you can put on the internet, what your face looks like, what your body looks like, what your home looks like, what your children look like, what your food looks like. And there's this temptation to spend so much energy crafting a set of images that basically have no bearing on our real lives. But a lot of people spend a lot of energy on it. And then a lot of people judge themselves really harshly when their life doesn't measure up to that. And so I think one of the best practices is just practicing understanding that who you are is so much more important than the image you're putting out into the world. Yeah. The person that you are in terms of character and lovingness and forgiveness and being willing to do brave things, that's so much more valuable, even though it's invisible. And so I think if I could be a part of a meaningful cultural conversation, it would be toward the insides, away from the images.
Mm. Well, it's hard to shut those off, especially with social media today. Even if I might take a Sabbath from my phone, it's just so easy to reach back into my pocket. And then it's like you're engaged again all of a sudden with other people's images or your own. And it's hard to put that away. And yet that seems completely countercultural to this simpler way of life.
Yeah. And, you know, the funny thing about social media is it's new enough where we don't really have meaningful boundaries or practices. We're all just sort of doing it and figuring it out. But, you know, I have a couple friends who will on and off in different seasons of life take their social media apps off their phones. They just say, for a while, it's just more helpful for me to not even have the option of pulling out my phone out of my pocket and scrolling through. Or I have friends who have certain hours of the day where they're not connected to social media. For me, one of the things that I'm challenging myself to do is when I have the impulse to open up one of the social media apps, instead I hit the texting button or I hit my Kindle app, because I find that texting, it gives me that connection that is what I'm looking for on social media, right? Mm-hmm. I'm looking for connection. So I text an actual human person with whom I have an actual relationship, instead of just scrolling through strangers' pictures. Or I hit my Kindle app and I read a story, because well-written stories bring me so much life and rest and restoration. And so I think it's up to each one of us to assess our own connection to social media and see if it's bringing us life and hope. And if it isn't, to really make some adjustments.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the other things I really appreciated in your book was just how you talked about not only taking some time away from social media, if that was helpful for you, but just this concept of silence and finding a way to be silence, even though you are an extrovert to the 10th degree. And so how do you kind of measure that, being an extrovert, with finding some silence? And has that been kind of a surprising friend for you, or has it been odd for you?
You know, it has been surprising. You know, I think I kind of thought that, like, you know, introverts have their set of spiritual practices, the contemplative ones, right? And then extroverts have other spiritual practices like hospitality and throwing parties, and, you know. And I think it's actually the opposite. I think my husband, who is an introvert, really benefits from connection with other people, from the practice of hospitality, from some of the more relational practices. And I think I, as an extrovert, really benefit from the contemplative practices. So I think it's whenever you kind of go a little bit against the grain of your natural impulse. My natural impulse is always toward noise. And so I'm finding silence to be an absolutely sacred, very life-changing practice for me.
So for the first time in your life, are you feeling strength from places that you didn't think you would draw strength from?
Oh, absolutely. For the first time in my life, I feel strongest when I'm alone. I feel most kind of like powerful or nourished when I choose rest and simplicity. I feel most confident and grounded when I'm home with my boys. This is a total reversal for me. I've been just zigzagging the entire planet for more action, more noise, more activity, more ways to try and push and succeed. And all of a sudden I'm finding it, you know, it was all right here, right? The sweetest, most life-changing, most valuable things I've been looking for everywhere are in the kitchen with my boys, are in the silence, are in the rest.
So I loved how you wrote about just having that time and freedom to spend some time on the floor playing with toys, because, of course, that's what boys like to do. And they want just time for you to spend that time with them. And I remember having that time of life where I felt like, oh, I should be doing something. Oh, I should be doing something. And it took quite a long time to get to the point where I didn't feel like that. Are you finding that you are kind of settled in this new routine, this way of life, this new being, I guess, that you've created for yourself?
You know, there are some aspects of it that are harder and some that are easier. But, you know, we joke about it now, my family, and they're wonderful, but they tease me about it, that, like, wow, you really are embracing this whole your house is a disaster, you know? And it's true. And, you know, so it used to be when they came over, everything was clean because I wanted them to see that I really took care of our home. And when they came over, I'd been cooking for a long time because I really wanted to nourish them. And I wanted to be creative and interesting. And quite often now they come over and the house is just a mess. And there is, you know, like a frozen pizza, for real. There's a frozen pizza in the oven. But I'm a better version of myself these days. And so they get a messier house and they get entirely non-gourmet food. And they get a girl who can sit down and listen instead of being so wound up she can't. Mm-hmm. They get a girl who can bring her whole self to a conversation instead of flitting around trying to complete 15 different things while people are standing in front of me. Mm-hmm. And so I think for the people that love me most, the trade-off has been worth it. But it's absolutely not without its consequences. I mean, I'm not in as good a shape as I used to be. Our house is messy. We eat more takeout. It's not as shiny. Mm-hmm. For me, it's better.
Mm-hmm. What do you think has been the biggest difference between the person you are now and the person you are before you began this journey?
I think I feel confident in my own abilities and my own limitations. I know who I am and who I'm not in a way I didn't before. And so it's much, much easier for me to say, that's something I can do. Oh, wait a minute. That is not. And I think that freedom has been really life-changing.
So if there are people who are kind of listening and they want to have a simpler way of life, but they're a little afraid to get started, what would be something you'd suggest for them? They've heard such wonderful things and an end game, but the beginning sounds still like it's going to be a little difficult.
You know, the first two things I would recommend is, number one, tell your everyday inner circle about this journey that you want to go on, because then they're in it with you, as opposed to like, wait a minute, things seem different. You seem different. What's happening? And they provide some accountability. Wait, didn't you say you were looking for a little more simplicity? Does this fit with that? So I feel like my kind of best friends and my husband were like the training wheels I've needed on this journey. And so the sooner you can get your people kind of to be a part of this conversation and this journey with you, the better. And then the second thing I would say is just start with little bits of silence, even 5 minutes a day. I mean, it seems like an hour and a half when you're first starting, but just 5 minutes a day and you'll start to discover what it is you've been avoiding, whatever that is, whatever thing you're afraid of, whatever thing needs handling, whatever thing you haven't wanted to face. You'll realize why you've kept yourself so busy. And that sort of gives you your starting point into how to move through it.
That's such a good word. Great word to end on, but I'd love to be able to just tell people how to get in contact with you to learn more about your writing. I'm guessing you're still pumping lots of information into your blog. And so how can people get in more contact with you?
Sure. They can go to ShaunaNequist.com or presentoverperfect.com or any of the social medias. Instagram is my favorite, and that's just at SNequist.
Wonderful. Shauna, thanks so much for taking some time to join with us and just for sharing this message. I think there are many women in the same predicament and just love to know that someone's on this journey with them.
Thank you. It's totally been my pleasure to talk with you.
Wonderful. Have blessings on your day, Shauna, and for all of you listening to Connecting Faith, have a great day. Well, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, I hope you had the opportunity to listen to my last half hour with guest Shauna Nequist and her new book, Present Over Perfect. If you've ever found yourself kind of knee deep in this frantic paced life, spending time and energy to please and impress others at the expense of connecting with those who are most important in your life, like your spouse, your children, your family, and God, then you'll benefit from listening to that candid conversation with Shauna. If you missed missed it, you can head to myfaithradio.com and click on Connecting Faith. And this half hour, we're going to dig a little bit deeper into that same notion as we explore the biblical concept of rest, why God not only created rest for our benefit, but prescribed it for us as a way to keep us closely connected to Him. My guest is author and professor John Kessler. John is chair of pastoral studies at Moody Bible Institute. He's the author of several books, including The Surprising Grace of Disappointment and True Discipleship. He and his wife Jane live in Northwest Indiana and have two sons. And his book that we're going to talk about today is called The Radical Pursuit of Rest, Escaping the Productivity Trap. Welcome, John.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you. How did you come to start exploring this concept of rest?
Well, like most of my books are sort of a form of self-therapy. You know, they kind of grow out of things that I'm either wrestling with in my own life, or they grow out of things that I'm puzzling over in terms of my experience with the church. And I think that was true for this, that for some time now I've been I've been disturbed by the what I might describe as the culture of productivity that seems the drivenness that I see in church experience, where you basically live with this assumption that our relationship in our relationship to God, that busier is better. And it's basically grounded in a supposition that devotion is reflected in activity. So the more you love Christ, the more you're going to do for Christ. And, of course, there's a trap in that, you know, that if that's true, then it means the people who love Christ the most, whether it's churches or individuals, are going to be the people who do most. But since your love for Christ should know no end, then your activity should know no end, you know, so you end up on this sort of spiritual treadmill. And so I not only sort of felt the pressure myself, but I think that message gets reinforced in the life of the church. So you end up coming there to encounter God, but then you sort of feel like if you're not producing something, if you don't add value in some way, then you really shouldn't be there. You know, there's really something wrong with you. And it really becomes a kind of a trap. So as a result, I started to reflect on this notion of what it really means to accept Christ's offer of the yoke of rest.
So it does kind of seem like even sometimes we look at spiritual gifts and make them somehow determinant on the kingdom purposes that we're using these spiritual gifts for, instead of, like you said, coming to church as a way to be part of that congregation, that we're using this giftedness as a way to say, well, you have to be doing and going, yeah, and using, instead of kind of accepting and being part of that worship experience.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of factors. Some of it is theological. I think that the church is has lost its sense on the reality of grace and the empowerment of God in the Christian life. There's been so much emphasis on what we are supposed to do, that we're really leaning into that in an unhealthy way. Obviously, you know, obedience is an important dimension of the Christian life, but I think, you know, Martin Luther said that before you take Christ as an example, you need to accept Him as a gift. And there's so much emphasis today on the example side that we forget that the ability to do these things really comes as a result of the gift of grace and the empowerment of the Holy Spirit. So that it almost comes to the place where you feel when you listen to what we hear preached in the church, that although we're saved by grace, it's really the effort that counts, you know, so we sort of flip that.
So the picture of biblical rest is possibly misunderstood, isn't it? What do people need to know about the rest as prescribed in the Bible? What did God really originally design rest for?
Well, I think the foundational promise is Christ's invitation, where He says, you know, come to Me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from Me, for I'm lowly in heart. You know, Jesus makes this fundamental promise to all who labor, this promise of rest. And it's a really kind of a shocking image that he uses when he uses this image of a yoke, because you think about the function of the yoke in New Testament times. It was for a beast of burden, right? You put a yoke on an animal so that the animal would carry the load. So there is this implication that when you come to Christ, there is work that you enter into. There is this life of discipleship. But the promise that Jesus makes there is a promise not of a burden, but the promise of rest. And of course, I think he's also suggesting in inviting us to take the yoke that we're already under a yoke. We're already under this sense of burden. We already, not just on a personal level, but it's reinforced all through our culture, this message that our value is a function of our performance. You know, how often when you're meeting somebody, is the first question that you ask, in fact, I just asked somebody this just today, just meeting them, saying to them, what do you do? Mm-hmm. what's your name? What do you do? Because that's how we get a sense of what people are worth. Well, that's not really true in God's sight. He doesn't value us primarily for what we do. He values us because he's created us. And what we are able to do comes as a result of his giving us the strength to do it, giving us the gifts to do it, empowering us by the Holy Spirit to do it. It's responsive in that sense, not causative. You know, we don't establish our identity in Christ on the basis of what we do. What we do grows out of who we are in Christ.
So you write that we don't work in order to justify the fact that we need rest. And we don't rest in order to justify that then we need to go to work, but that rest is more of our destiny. Can you just talk more about that and help us understand that?
Yes. Somebody a while back when they were talking to me about the book, and they said, you know, all this talk about rest, disciplines of rest, it just makes me tired. In fact, that's one of the stumbling blocks that people have. You know, that we think primarily of rest as a discipline. It's, again, it becomes one of the things that we put on our do list to say, oh, great, you know, now all the other things I'm not doing, I'm not resting now. Now I need to rest. But the resting is not rest any more than eating is food, right? You know, it's possible for me to engage in modes where I'm trying to rest that really don't net out in rest in my experience. Anybody who's gone to Disney World on vacation knows what that's like, right? You go on vacation and then you come back and you say, wow, I'm totally exhausted. I really need some rest. I think something similar can happen in the Christian life, that you really have to recognize that the rest that Christ offers initially is a state of being. In fact, that's how the writer of Hebrews describes it, as if it's a location. You know, he talks about entering into rest. Make every effort to enter into this rest. That when Jesus makes his offer, he offers to give us this rest, so that all of the practices of rest, things, if there are disciplines of rest that we would practice, like the practice of Sabbath, all of those things really begin with a gift. This rest that Christ gives us, which really is the recognition that everything that needs to be done to put me in a right relationship with God, everything that validates me in God's sight, is something that's already been done on my behalf. Mm-hmm. And the actions that I take now when I'm trying to live the Christian life, when I'm trying to serve Christ, when I'm trying to have a meaningful vocation, have, you know, work at a job and support my family, all of that grows out of rest, not into rest. So rest is not the objective. Rest is, in that sense, rest is, in the Christian life, rest is not the ending point that I'm trying to work myself into. Rest is the starting point. It is also the ending point in that, you know, this whole Christian life is tending toward eternal rest that Christ will provide for us. When you see the picture of, for example, you see the picture of the saints under the altar, that one of the things that's said to them is rest a little longer. They enter into a state of rest. But even that, which is really interesting, you see the rest of heaven as described in the book of Revelation, it's active. It's not passive rest. It's not like people just floating around on clouds and not really doing anything. And I think the same is true of the rest that we experience now in the Christian life. When we take up the yoke of rest, it's not, we're not just saying, yeah, okay, you come to Jesus, then you just don't do anything. You know, you just don't do anything. Fact is, the Christian life is very active, but it is an activity that we're not doing it in order to establish a relationship with Christ. We're not doing it to earn points. We're doing it because we are already in a relationship, and we're doing it out of this power that has been given to us by God as a result of that relationship.
Well, I'm talking to John Kessler today about his book, The Radical Pursuit of Rest. We'll talk about how that applies to maybe your church experience or your experience at work. How do we enter into this state of understanding what it means to be at rest with our walk with the Lord, and then add that to just the way that we live? We'll be right back on Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Joe Bender, and I'm talking to author and professor John Kessler about his book, The Radical Pursuit of Rest, Escaping the Productivity Trap. You know, John, one of the things that it seems that our culture is engaged in is how fast can we get from point A to point B? And we seem to be valued mostly on our production than on really who we are without producing. And it seems like the church has kind of grabbed part of that as well. If you're a member of a church, you need to be working toward this kingdom purpose and not just coming to worship and engage with other parishioners. How do you put rest into that kind of situation?
Yeah, this is a real concern for me, because I do think that the church, because the church is rooted in culture, and because you know, our culture in general tends to value people on the basis of what they have produced, what they have achieved. That mentality seeps its way into the church. That is, I think what you have is you have a church. The word that I used to describe the church today is that it's driven. You know, so the church is always trying to increase whatever its level of activity is. If its attendance has grown, then it wants the attendance to grow further. If the programs have expanded, then they have to expand even more, so that the church is rolling out new initiatives the way I think automobile companies often roll out new model cars. And of course, whatever the latest one needs to be more fabulous than the last one. So puts tremendous pressure then on worshipers. You know, when we come together as God's people, the message, and it's not even an implicit message today. I think it's explicit. Often I've heard it stated from the pulpit, where the worship leader will say something like, "Well, if you only came here to worship," you know, the implied statement is, if you only came here to worship, you're a spiritual deadbeat. You know, basically, you need to get busy. You know, you need to go work in the nursery, or you need to go engage in whatever the latest service project is. I think one of the terrible results of that kind of thinking is that it marginalizes worship in the life of the church. I don't see that marginal sense when I look at the way the New Testament approaches worship. You know, they seem to place this experience of coming together to experience the reality of God's presence very high as a priority for them, and that really I think that is the pinnacle of what the church is doing. It isn't to say that, therefore, it doesn't matter whether you serve Christ. That is not the message when it comes to rest. But I think when you come to the place where you see that, where you begin to feel like the only way that I can justify my presence in worship is by doing something else, you really end up marginalizing the reality of worship. And I think it becomes then a kind of a treadmill that we're a spiritual treadmill that we're on. I feel like the church has become like a service industry. Kind of, I don't know if they still have it anymore, but do you remember Amway, how, you know, you would get people, you get these people on board to sort of push the product. And that's kind of how it feels a little bit in the church today, that the church is sort of selling itself. In fact, I think even when it comes to worship, that's what the church is marketing. It's really trying to use worship, instead of making worship the focal point for God's people, it becomes a marketing tool. And it's what we're using to attract people. It's kind of the product that we're trying to push. And we're in competition with every other church that's around us. And then so the worshipers then feel like, you know, it's I'm working for the church. I'm trying to sell that product. I don't know if that makes sense, if that's a little confusing.
Sure. So the state of being that the Lord is calling us into, which is to have this assurance that we are His, that our identity is secure in Christ, the state of being allows us to serve out of that place of rest that we're trying to get to, rather than the opposite, which is serving as a path to get to that state of being.
Right. And I think we have to come to recognize that worship is not a performance. You know, we're not entertaining God when we worship. And the goal of worship is not to perform in the practical sense of the word. We're not producing something for God when we worship. There is a real sense in which worship is an activity, but it is an activity that's meaningful in itself. It really doesn't have to serve any other purpose. And those who come to church who are expecting to receive something from the experience of worship, they are not abusing it. That is really a central part of our experience with God, and it really is one of the ways that we put ourselves in touch with the reality of the rest that Christ has provided for us.
So this receiving, as in receiving teaching or receiving worship, is really just as important as the doing for the Christ follower.
It's actually essential for it, you know, because that's when you look at when Paul describes, you know, the gifts in Ephesians 4. One of the things that he says is that these gifts are given to the church in order to equip the church to do the work of ministry. The context where we come or put into touch with the ministry of these gifted individuals is the context of worship. That really, I would disagree with people who basically would say that if you're coming here just to receive something, there's a problem with it. I think, really, honestly, that is what we're doing when we come together as God's people. We are all coming to receive from, first and foremost, from God, and from the mutual ministry of one another. You know, when I come into the church to even to exercise my own gifts, why am I doing that? Because somebody needs it, because somebody needs to receive it.
So Sabbath, is that the same as rest when people talk about taking a Sabbath?
Sabbath, that's an interesting practice in Scripture. You know, first of all, we have to recognize that when it comes to the church's understanding of the notion of Sabbath, that the church has been divided on it, that you know, the Christian church has never had a uniform perspective on whether or not we should continue to observe the Sabbath. Of course, Sabbath begins with God's Old Testament people. It becomes part of the law, and not just part of, you know, not just one day a week, but what you see is this Sabbath principle basically shot through several festivals and observances in Israel's practice, where in a sense they are structuring their lives in order to put them in a position where they have to recognize their dependence upon God. You know, so if I'm not going to work, the normal order is, it's an order that God established himself, if you, you know, in order to eat, you have to work. In order to reap, you have to sow. And, you know, there's several really remarkable points where God basically commands his people not to engage in these normal modes of providing for themselves, because God is going to provide for them. Mm-hmm. When you come into the New Testament, you don't see the Sabbath law repeated, but you have the Sabbath principle emphasized, particularly in the book of Hebrews. And the focus then is not on a particular day. In fact, Paul warns in Colossians, he warns the church not to let anybody judge them in the observance of a particular day. But the focus then becomes on Jesus Christ, so that all of these observances both point to the rest that Christ provides, and also worked into the early experience of God's Old Testament people, this principle of what the New Testament would describe as the kingdom, you know, God ordering our lives, God's control over our lives, ultimately over the whole world and providing for us. There is a discipline, there is a Sabbath discipline that can be valuable to practice, where you intentionally refrain from work. And actually, you can apply it in other areas. I think, you know, one of the areas we really need to practice Sabbath today is in digital culture. You know, I'm finding that I'm trying to practice Sabbath by not reading my emails on Sunday, you know, which I found really, like, I go into withdrawal. You know, I did, one Sunday I did it. I felt really good about it. And then the next Sunday it was like, what if it's really important? It never is. So, but there are a lot of areas where you can intentionally set aside things that, you know, normally are ways that you structure your lives, you provide for yourself. You do it intentionally, both to sort of create space for an awareness for God, and also to make yourself aware of how God will care for you, how God will take care of business for you, how you can, you know, I can step outside of the world that I am, that I see myself as being so central in, and I discover that the world goes on really well without me, because it's God's world. And there's a relief in that.
It does seem like this concept of rest that we are to place ourselves in really requires a large amount of trust on our part.
Yes. I think there's I think the two are synonymous, that, you know, this experience of rest is also an experience of faith. One of the analogies that I find really helpful is when I think about what happens with sleep, you know, what happens when you go to sleep at night? You know, there's a sense for you really, in fact, there's a kind of theology of sleep that you see developed in the scriptures. The psalmist talks about God providing him with sleep. You really put yourself in the hands of God when you go to sleep at night, because you are, you know, you disengage from the world around you. You are really, if you think about it, you're extremely vulnerable because you're not even conscious. You expect the world to go on without you. You expect God to protect you and, you know, to take care of your business when you're asleep, and then you awake in the morning and you step back into your ordinary life. And I think that is really the pattern of rest in all of its forms. It's an exercise of trust, of confidence that God has me in the palm of his hand, that he is looking out for my interests, that he will provide all that I need, and that he will energize me for the things that I need to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, John Kessler, that's just a great word to end our interview on. Our time went way too fast, because that's the world that we live in, isn't it?
Yes, it is. That's why we need rest.
It's why we need rest. The Radical Pursuit of Rest, Escaping the Productivity Trap, is the title of John Kessler's new book. I hope you'll grab a copy of it. We do have a few to give away, so if you're listening today and you'd like to get on that list, please go to myfaithradio.com, click on Connecting Faith, and you'll be able to submit your name and your address that way, and we can get one of those books into your hands. John, thanks so much for joining us today, and I wish you well as you engage your students this year at Moody.
Thanks very much.